Chapter 65. So, on the 16th of December, 1653, a great procession was formed at Oliver's door, and he came out in a black velvet suit, and a big pair of boots, and got into his coach, and went down to Westminster, attended by the judges, and the Lord Mayor, and the aldermen, and all the other great and wonderful personages of the country. There, in the Court of Chancery, he publicly accepted the office of Lord Protector. Then he was sworn, and the city sword was handed to him, and the seal was handed to him, and all the other things were handed to him which are usually handed to kings and queens on state occasions. When Oliver had handed them all back, he was quite made, and completely finished off as Lord Protector. And several of the Ironsides preached about it at great length, all the evening. Second part, Oliver Cromwell, whom the people long called Old Nolan, accepting the office of protector, had bound himself by a certain paper which was handed to him, called the instrument, apostrophe to summon a parliament, consisting of between 400 and 500 members, in the election of which neither the royalists, nor the Catholics were to have any share. He had also pledged himself that this parliament should not be dissolved without its own consent until it had sat 5 months. When this parliament met, Oliver made a speech to them of 3 hours long, very wisely advising them what to do for the credit and happiness of the country. To keep down the more violent members, he required them to sign a recognition of what they were forbidden by the instrument to do, which was, chiefly, to take the power from one single person at the head of the state, or to command the army. Then he dismissed them to go to work. With his usual vigor and resolution he went to work himself with some frantic preachers who were rather overdoing their sermons in calling him a villain and a tyrant, by shutting up their chapels, and sending a few of them off to prison. There was not at that time, in England or anywhere else, a man so able to govern the country as Oliver Cromwell. Although he ruled with a strong hand, and levied a very heavy tax on the royalists, but not until they had plotted against his life, he ruled wisely, and as the times required. He caused England to be so respected abroad, that I wish some lords and gentlemen who have governed it under kings and queens in later days would have taken a leaf out of Oliver Cromwell's book. He sent bold Admiral Blake to the Mediterranean Sea, to make the Duke of Tuscany pay £60,000 for injuries he had done to British subjects, and spoliation he had committed on English merchants. He further dispatched him and his fleet to Algiers, Tunis, and Tripoli, to have every English ship and every English man delivered up to him that had been taken by pirates in those parts. All this was gloriously done, and it began to be thoroughly well known, all over the world, that England was governed by a man in earnest, who would not allow the English name to be insulted or slighted anywhere. These were not all his foreign triumphs. He sent a fleet to sea against the Dutch, and the two powers, each with 100 ships upon its side, met in the English Channel off the north for land, where the fight lasted all day long. Dean was killed in this fight, but Monk, who commanded in the same ship with him, threw his cloak over his body, that the sailors might not know of his death, and be disheartened. Nor were they. The English broadsides so exceedingly astonished the Dutch, that they sheered off at last, though the redoubtable Van Tromp fired upon them with his own guns for deserting their flag. Soon afterwards, the two fleets engaged again, off the coast of Holland. There, the valiant Van Tromp was shot through the heart, and the Dutch gave in, and peace was made. Further than this, Oliver resolved not to bear the domineering and bigoted conduct of Spain, which country not only claimed a right to all the gold and silver that could be found in South America, and treated the ships of all other countries who visited those regions as pirates, but put English subjects into the horrible Spanish prisons of the Inquisition. So, Oliver told the Spanish ambassador that English ships must be free to go wherever they would, and that English merchants must not be thrown into those same dungeons. No, not for the pleasure of all the priests in Spain. To this, the Spanish ambassador replied that the gold and silver country and the Holy Inquisition were his king's two eyes, neither of which he could submit to have put out. Very well, said Oliver. Then he was afraid Oliver must damage those two eyes directly. So, another fleet was dispatched under two commanders, Penn and Venables, for Hispaniola, where, however, the Spaniards got the better of the fight. Consequently, the fleet came home again, after taking Jamaica on the way. Oliver, indignant with the two commanders who had not done what bold Admiral Blake would have done, clapped them both into prison, declared war against Spain, and made a treaty with France, in virtue of which it was to shelter the king and his brother the Duke of York no longer. Then, he sent a fleet abroad under bold Admiral Blake, which brought the King of Portugal to his senses, just to keep its hand in, and then engaged a Spanish fleet, sunk four great ships, and took two more, laden with silver to the value of 2 millions of pounds, which dazzling prize was brought from Portsmouth to London in wagons, with the populace of all the towns and villages through which the wagons passed, shouting with all their might. After this victory, bold Admiral Blake sailed away to the port of Santa Cruz, to cut off the Spanish treasure ships coming from Mexico. There, he found them, 10 in number, with 7 others to take care of them, and a big castle, and 7 batteries, all roaring and blazing away at him with great guns. Blake cared no more for great guns than for pop guns, no more for their hot iron balls than for snowballs. He dashed into the harbor, captured and burned every one of the ships, and came sailing out again triumphantly, with the victorious English flag flying at his masthead. This was the last triumph of this great commander, who had sailed and fought until he was quite worn out. He died, as his successful ship was coming into Plymouth Harbor amidst the joyful acclamations of the people, and was buried in state in Westminster Abbey. Not to lie there long. Over and above all this, Oliver found that the Vaudois, or Protestant people of the valleys of Lucerne, were insolently treated by the Catholic powers, and were even put to death for their religion, in an audacious and bloody manner. Instantly, he informed those powers that this was a thing which Protestant England would not allow, and he speedily carried his point, through the might of his great name, and established their right to worship God in peace after their own harmless manner. Lastly, his English army won such admiration in fighting with the French against the Spaniards, that, after they had assaulted the town of Dunkirk together, the French king in person gave it up to the English, that it might be a token to them of their might and valor. There were plots enough against Oliver among the frantic religionists who called themselves Fifth Monarchy men, and among the disappointed republicans. He had a difficult game to play, for the royalists were always ready to side with either party against him. The king over the water, (2), as Charles was called, had no scruples about plotting with anyone against his life, although there is reason to suppose that he would willingly have married one of his daughters, if Oliver would have had such a son-in-law. There was a certain Colonel Saxby of the army, once a great supporter of Oliver's, but now turned against him, who was a grievous trouble to him through all this part of his career, and who came and went between the discontented in England and Spain, and Charles, who put himself in alliance with Spain on being thrown off by France. This man died in prison at last, but not until there had been very serious plots between the royalists and republicans, and an actual rising of them in England, when they burst into the city of Salisbury, on a Sunday night, seized the judges who were going to hold the assizes there next day, and would have hanged them, but for the merciful objections of the more temperate of their number. Oliver was so vigorous and shrewd that he soon put this revolt down, as he did most other conspiracies, and it was well for one of its chief managers, that same Lord Wilmot who had assisted in Charles's flight, and was now Earl of Rochester, that he made his escape. Oliver seemed to have eyes and ears everywhere, and secured such sources of information as his enemies little dreamed of. There was a chosen body of 6 persons, called the Sealed Knot, who were in the closest and most secret confidence of Charles. One of the foremost of these very men, a Sir Richard Willis, reported to Oliver everything that passed among them, and had 200 a year for it. Miles Cindercombe, also of the old army, was another conspirator against the Protector. He and a man named Cecil bribed one of his lifeguards to let them have good notice when he was going out intending to shoot him from a window. But, owing either to his caution or his good fortune, they could never get an aim at him. Disappointed in this design, they got into the chapel in Whitehall, with a basket full of combustibles, which were to explode by means of a slow match in 6 hours. Then, in the noise and confusion of the fire, they hoped to kill Oliver. But, the lifeguardsman himself disclosed this plot, and they were seized, and Miles died or killed himself in prison, a little while before he was ordered for execution. A few such plotters Oliver caused to be beheaded, a few more to be hanged, and many more, including those who rose in arms against him, to be sent as slaves to the West Indies. If he were rigid, he was impartial to, in asserting the laws of England. When a Portuguese nobleman, the brother of the Portuguese ambassador, killed a London citizen in mistake for another man with whom he had had a quarrel, Oliver caused him to be tried before a jury of Englishmen and foreigners, and had him executed in spite of the entreaties of all the ambassadors in London. One of Oliver's own friends, the Duke of Oldenburg, in sending him a present of 6 fine coach horses, was very near doing more to please the royalists than all the plotters put together. One day, Oliver went with his coach, drawn by these 6 horses, into Hyde Park, to dine with his secretary and some of his other gentlemen under the trees there. After dinner, being merry, he took it into his head to put his friends inside, and to drive them home. A postillion riding one of the foremost horses, as the custom was. On account of Oliver's being too free with the whip, the 6 fine horses went off at a gallop, the postillion got thrown, and Oliver fell upon the coach pole, and narrowly escaped being shot by his own pistol, which got entangled with his clothes in the harness, and went off. He was dragged some distance by the foot, until his foot came out of the shoe, and then he came safely to the ground under the broad body of the coach, and was very little the worse. The gentlemen inside were only bruised, and the discontented people of all parties were much disappointed. The rest of the history of the Protectorate of Oliver Cromwell is a history of his parliaments. His first one not pleasing him at all, he waited until the 5 months were out, and then dissolved it. The next was better suited to his views, and from that he desired to get, if he could with safety to himself, the title of king. He had had this in his mind some time. Whether because he thought that the English people, being more used to the title, were more likely to obey it, or whether because he really wished to be a king himself, and to leave the succession to that title in his family, is far from clear. He was already as high, in England and in all the world, as he would ever be, and I doubt if he cared for the mere name. However, a paper, called the Humble Petition and Advice, apostrophe was presented to him by the House of Commons, praying him to take a high title, and to appoint his successor. That he would have taken the title of king there is no doubt, but for the strong opposition of the army. This induced him to forbear, and to assent only to the other points of the petition. Upon which occasion there was another grand show in Westminster Hall, when the Speaker of the House of Commons formally invested him with a purple robe lined with ermine, and presented him with a splendidly bound Bible, and put a golden scepter in his hand. The next time the Parliament met, he called a House of Lords of 60 members, as the petition gave him power to do. But as that Parliament did not please him either, and would not proceed to the business of the country, he jumped into a coach one morning, took 6 guards with him, and sent them to the rightabout. I wish this had been a warning to parliaments to avoid long speeches, and do more work. It was the month of August, 1658, when Oliver Cromwell's favorite daughter, Elizabeth Claypole, who had lately lost her youngest son, lay very ill, and his mind was greatly troubled, because he loved her dearly. Another of his daughters was married to Lord Falconberg, another to the grandson of the Earl of Warwick, and he had made his son Richard one of the members of the upper house. He was very kind and loving to them all, being a good father and a good husband. But he loved this daughter the best of the family, and went down to Hampton Court to see her, and could hardly be induced to stir from her sick room until she died. Although his religion had been of a gloomy kind, his disposition had been always cheerful. He had been fond of music in his home, and had kept open table once a week for all officers of the army, not below the rank of captain, and had always preserved in his house a quiet, sensible dignity. He encouraged men of genius and learning, and loved to have them about him. Milton was one of his great friends. He was good-humored too, with the nobility, whose dresses and manners were very different from his. And to show them what good information he had, he would sometimes jokingly tell them, when they were his guests, where they had last drunk the health of the king over the water, apostrophe, and would recommend them to be more private if they could, another time. But he had lived in busy times, had borne the weight of heavy state affairs, and had often gone in fear of his life. He was ill of the gout and ague. And when the death of his beloved child came upon him in addition, he sank, never to raise his head again. He told his physicians on the 24th of August that the Lord had assured him that he was not to die in that illness, and that he would certainly get better. This was only his sick fancy, for on the 3rd of September, which was the anniversary of the great battle of Worcester, and the day of the year which he called his fortunate day, he died, in the 60th year of his age. He had been delirious, and had lain insensible some hours, but he had been overheard to murmur a very good prayer the day before. The whole country lamented his death. If you want to know the real worth of Oliver Cromwell, and his real services to his country, you can hardly do better than compare England under him, with England under Charles II. He had appointed his son Richard to succeed him, and after there had been, at Somerset House in the Strand, a lying in state more splendid than sensible as all such vanities after death are, I think Richard became Lord Protector. He was an amiable country gentleman, but had none of his father's great genius, and was quite unfit for such a post in such a storm of parties. Richard's protectorate, which only lasted a year and a half, is a history of quarrels between the officers of the army and the parliament, and between the officers among themselves, and of a growing discontent among the people, who had far too many long sermons and far too few amusements, and wanted a change. At last, General Monk got the army well into his own hands, and then in pursuance of a secret plan he seems to have entertained from the time of Oliver's death, declared for the king's cause. He did not do this openly, but, in his place in the House of Commons, as one of the members for Devonshire, strongly advocated the proposals of one Sir John Greenville, who came to the house with a letter from Charles, dated from Breda, and with whom he had previously been in secret communication. There had been plots and counterplots, and a recall of the last members of the Long Parliament, and an end of the Long Parliament, and risings of the Royalists, that were made too soon, and most men being tired out, and there being no one to head the country now great Oliver was dead, it was readily agreed to welcome Charles Stuart. Some of the wiser and better members said what was most true, that in the letter from Breda, he gave no real promise to govern well, and that it would be best to make him pledge himself beforehand, as to what he should be bound to do for the benefit of the kingdom. Monk said, however, it would be all right when he came, and he could not come too soon. So, everybody found out all in a moment that the country must be prosperous and happy, having another Stuart to condescend to reign over it, and there was a prodigious firing off of guns, lighting of bonfires, ringing of bells, and throwing up of caps. The people drank the king's health by thousands, in the open streets, and everybody rejoiced. Down came the arms of the Commonwealth, up. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.